This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Spring officially starts in 3 days, but in our area, there's always a chance of frost, maybe even snow for at least a few more weeks. In the meantime, we can start getting our gardens and yards ready for the warmer months ahead. And joining us with advice on doing that, Executive Director of ThisLand.org and Chairman of the City of Cincinnati's Urban Agriculture Advisory Board, Braden Trouth, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger. Call us with your gardening questions, 513-419-7100. You can also email us, talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sarah, Peter, and Braden, thanks for being here this afternoon. Good to see everybody.
Hello.
Peter, temperatures are supposed to hit the lows in like 31, 32, I think was the range I saw between Saturday and Tuesday. Is that going to damage anything that's already in bloom? And should people be covering things like their crocuses, their tulips, and things like that?
Well, I know in regards to like our fruit trees, a lot of the peaches are already blooming. So we're going to try and kind of deal with that. Or plums, these things that set fruit early could be damaged. Depending on the size of the tree, it could be possible or impossible to cover. The other thing is if you've done any early sowing, like a lot of people already have carrots or peas in the ground, I would recommend putting a light row cover over those.
Okay. Again, 513-419-7100 to join us. And what should people be doing at this point to get their yards and their gardens ready? What are some of the projects they should be taking on?
Well, for lawn and turf in the home, you want to make sure that you're getting your mowers ready. If you haven't already done so, sharpen your blades, get the things out, making sure you have the gasoline and everything ready, because once the soil starts to dry out a little bit more, we're going to be hearing those things turning on and people are going to start mowing. So making sure that we have all of that, and I'm sure people are, if they choose to get rid of some of our weeds in our lawn, you may want to do a post-emergent and pre-emergent on some of the weeds.
So should you aerate right now, or is that something you should do in the fall?
You want to do that in the fall of the year. Especially you don't want to do that now when the soil has been very wet with all this rain. So that can actually further compact the soil, which we don't want to do, especially in our clay soils in Kentucky and the northern Kentucky region.
You know, to aerate the soil as well, one technique that Dr. Ingham, who's one of my teachers, would always recommend is doing soil microbiology as well, doing good compost and things like that. So,
and what other advice do you have for getting your garden, your yard ready, Braden?
You know, right now, a lot of it is preparing what I'm actually going to plant, and which, you know, I've been doing for the last couple months, but actually getting it ready to get in the ground. And so, you know, there's that currently, you know, at our nursery that we run through thisland.org, we're getting all the plants into pots and getting everything ready. I will say spring has come a little bit earlier than expected. So it's, you know, typically we have another month, but with these 70 degree days, everything's popping out.
So. Yeah. I'm amazed how green my grass has gotten all of a sudden.
Grass is growing. I've been noticing it in my backyard. So.
Well, another thing you can still do is, you know, our end of frost date is until March 18th. I always try and remember it by Mother's Day, which is a few days earlier. May 18th. Mm. And so what you want to do is to you can do some – still start some seeds indoors, and then you can set those plants out in after May 15th or May 18th and transplant them into your garden. There are still some things – but there are some things you could actually plant now. Now, one thing you want to be careful of, the soil is still pretty wet, and you don't want to work your – I'm talking about vegetable gardens here, your vegetable garden beds. You don't want to work that soil if it isn't well drained. It'll cause clumping and give you a big headache for a long time. But as soon as the soil is dry enough to work, you can weed it, get in, and then do some planting. Like, for instance, in March, you can plant peas, cilantro, radish, turnip, arugula, and you can even – a lot of people around St. Patrick's Day will do their plant their seed potato. Beets and other root vegetables can also be direct sown. And like I said, if it gets very cold, you can put like a floating row cover over it or a light covering of straw.
So what isn't safe to plant right now?
Well, you don't want to put out tomatoes, you know, anything, peppers, anything that's tender.
Yeah. I mean, really, currently, you'd want to have some of your late winter, early spring crops, mustards, lettuce, things like that, that can handle frost. And, you know, we really aren't out of the woods yet. You never know.
Right.
It's always really fun to note that we actually have three growing seasons for our vegetable crops, which, you know, beginning gardeners may not realize. So it's really fun to get in there now. So make sure you remember that we can actually grow things three times a year to enjoy through Christmas, Thanksgiving, and some of our other holidays. And to note, you know, on crops, if you haven't already, order your catalogs. Make sure you have your seeds ordered or a seed saver exchange group that you may have. So, and if you're not sure what to get, that's where you call your local extension office.
Peter, so you were talking about potatoes earlier. Mm-hmm. So in honor of St. Patrick's Day, and of course, anybody who's seen The Martian, they now know how to grow potatoes. Let's talk a little bit more about that. How difficult are potatoes to grow?
Well, potatoes are really very easy to grow. You know, one thing I do recommend, the temptation may be just to get some potatoes from that you have left over from the store or something and plant them. It's not a good idea.
Not going to work well?
Yeah, well, it'll work, but there can be some issues with fungal diseases and different things. So you want to do is get like a certified seed potato, and there's nurseries or mail order catalogs and where you can get those. And even in town now, a lot of the nurseries are carrying potatoes and onion sets, which are small onion bulbs that you can plant out. It's very interesting. I mean, what you do is when you plant them, and then with the regular potatoes, what you do is you mound them as the plant grows up. And so that provides kind of more of a loose soil base for them to grow into. And it's a longer season. I mean, depending on the variety potato, you could be harvesting in June and July. And the sweet potato is not a potato related to potato directly. It's actually in the same family as a morning glory. But you plant sweet potato slips after the danger of the first frost in mid to late May. And that's a very long season crop. You don't harvest those to the fall. Now, what's easy about these two crops is after they establish themselves, they have a nice heavy set of leaves and vines. And so a sort of self-weed. You have to weed them at first, and it's a very low maintenance crop and fairly high yield. So if someone has, gets overwhelmed mid-season, would not be able to keep up with their garden, you know, dedicate a third or a half of it to potato and sweet potato crops is a good way to go. If you're doing a food pantry or, say, a faith-based organization that's distributing food to the population, people really like potatoes, and particularly sweet potatoes will be good and ripe around this, and you can save them till Thanksgiving to distribute to people.
How much space do you need to do this, to plant potatoes?
Well, really, I mean, to make it worthwhile, you want to plant a bed at least, 4 by 8 feet. Yeah, so I think that's kind of the minimum. And we usually, when I'm doing if you have a raised wooden bed in your yard that's 4 by 8 feet, you could do that. Or if you only want, or at least do half of it. And for regular potatoes, not sweet potatoes, you want to do the whole bed. And then you could still do kind of like a half and half.
Braden, any advice on growing potatoes?
Well, I was going to say sweet potatoes are also a great edible landscaping that you can incorporate into your landscape if you want to, get a yield out of it as well. They're beautiful and just follow the advice that Peter had suggested there. So.
Yeah, and a few years ago, I worked with some refugees from Burundi, Africa, and they taught me to eat the leaves. And
really?
So you can judiciously harvest the leaves, and they're very tasty.
One thing I will advise about potatoes and a lot of our root crops, actually, is soil management. And we really want to make sure with our soils around here tend to be clay and hold a lot of moisture. So we want to make sure we increase our soil profile, some organic matter, raise that up. We, at the Extension Office in Campbell County, we have raised beds. Now, we implement good management for our soil, put compost and horse manure in there. And so that allows for good drainage. And because if you have really heavy soils and clay soils and moist soils, they will rot quickly and yield will be very low and disappointing. And this is a really fun crop for children to then harvest. So if you have youth in your neighborhood or in your family, I encourage you to try this if you haven't done it before. getting your hands dirty, taking that any type of equipment to lift that soil up, and worms included. You know, you lift that soil up, and there you have a whole handful of potatoes that you can hopefully then cook with your family all together and enjoy those.
Braden, do potatoes do well all organic?
It depends. I mean, I think there are a lot of farmers around here who do a lot of organic potatoes. But I haven't had as much experience with our typical potatoes. Sweet potatoes, a little bit more experience, but
I find them. I mean, they are susceptible to some pests, but I've had very little problem with them in the community gardens and home gardens. We've had very good luck with them, and I think, like you had mentioned, was mentioned about good. Well-drained soil is important. That's why a lot of times, you keep building the soil up around them because it lifts the plant up and it facilitates that drainage.
Another permaculture technique that, we always push is just diversity, and really what caused the Irish potato famine was a lack of diversity. So if you can get a diverse crop, hopefully you'll get a decent yield if pests do come in and, start causing
problems. Any particular varieties of potatoes?
I've done some purple potatoes before. It's great because they're not your standard potatoes that are, your standard white potatoes, but
blue potatoes, yeah. In some of these fancier restaurants, if you will, you may have those, the smashed blue potatoes. Yeah. They taste very similar, but on the plate, they look very interesting, and it's fun to show the children what is a typical potato look like. And carrots is another fun one. What's a typical color of a carrot? And then you show them purple and all these other various colors of reds and oranges. So it's fun. The fingerling potatoes. So you can definitely get these types of potatoes, mail order them in, or some of our local nurseries that will have them, and just try some.
I mean, the Peruvians had 5,000 types of potatoes, which that really creates resilience.
Didn't know there were that many types of potatoes.
Yeah. It's, when you get into plant genetics and everything, it's really interesting to witness and understand that, this is our heritage, and that's how you bypass issues like the Irish potato famine on St. Patrick's Day here. So
with diversity.
Yeah. So, and don't plant it from the root crop. You've got to do it from seed, which creates that genetic diversity. So
when we were mentioning about pests, of course, they're very susceptible to a beetle, the potato beetle, and using row covers is a really good, that they're very susceptible to that. So implementing good best management practices, so therefore you don't have to use any type of chemical control, their life cycle, you understand the entomology science behind that. So if you're not aware of that, that's, again, where you reach out to your extension office and we can help you with that.
And we'll continue our gardening conversation. You can join us with your questions, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Our horticulture experts join us this afternoon to answer your gardening questions. Executive Director of ThisLand.org and Chairman of the City of Cincinnati Urban Agriculture Advisory Board, Braden Trouth, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sarah, you want to talk about the farmer's market?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go right ahead.
So we've been talking about wonderful food. My stomach is growling a little bit as we're doing that. But, I hope that we're a backyard gardener or a farmer by trade, or it may be a hobby, but I hope that we all have grown to appreciate where our food comes from and all the hard work that our farmers have to do. So, and hopefully you can stop by your farmer's market and introduce yourself to the local farmers and build a connection and a relationship with your farmer. And I just want to mention that the Campbell County Farmers Market will be starting the 2016 Farmers Market on May 17th. And that will be at the Highlands Height location on Tuesdays from 3 to 7. We will also have the Alexandria location on Fridays starting May 20th from 3 to 6. And also down in Newport on Saturday starting May 21st from 9 to noon.
And Peter, any classes going on?
Yeah, at Turner Farm, you can check out the listing of classes there on our website at turnerfarm.org. And later this month, there's a series of five classes on vegetable gardening for the home and community gardener that we'll be doing at the Franciscan Community Center at Centennial Barn. It's a collaboration between us and Turner Farm, and that's part of our Learn, Grow, Earn program, where you participate in five classes, and if you do some volunteer work afterwards, Turner Farm will pay for a garden bed in your own yard. So it's a nice program. And then Melinda Brandt, the head of adult education at Turner Farm, will be doing more advanced gardening classes at Turner Farm throughout the season. So check us out on the website, turnerfarm.org.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Elizabeth in Springfield. Hi, Elizabeth. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Elizabeth. Go right ahead.
I was wondering about the English ivy in my yard. It's a little bit out of control, and it has leaves in it from the fall, and I was wondering how to get that under control.
All right. Well, I'll be glad to help you. So English ivy, and some folks may consider that a very invasive plant, but we know that aesthetically it can add really nice curb appeal to our home landscape. But since it is very aggressive in our landscape, and actually their root in there, how they adhere themselves to our mortar and to our bricks can be very challenging to remove. So I caution you on removing that if it is onto your home or on a siding or any type of structure, because it can cause some damage. But my suggestion to you, is this a well-established type? No? Okay. So possibly, you know, if it's established, you may just want to, you can thin it out, or you can mow it actually. But if at all possible, just do some thinning out, because it can get over established and it can start decaying and rotting out. So I hope that answers all your questions on English ivy.
Any other suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I think just removing it by hand, that's what I've done a lot of around my house, so. That when I bought the house, it was already established there. So, yeah.
Victor emailed. He has drainage problems. Someone suggested a vertical French drain and sump pump, and then he wanted to get your thoughts on suggestions to drain.
Now, is this for a basement or for a yard? No. Yeah, I mean, you can do vertical sub pumps, which are, you know, costly and expensive.
And it is a yard, by the way.
Oh, yes. It is,
okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I mean, that certainly was one option. Another way is that people use perforated pipe, and if your property is sloped, you can trench and then lay this perforated pipe and then backfill with some pea gravel and then put system fabric on top of that and soil and put your grass or whatever back on top. And the idea is if you can take that pipe and daylight it to a lower area where it can drain would be one solution. Another solution is people will, it's called tiling, and they'll just trench and then put in these pipes. And a lot of times they put a cloth sock on them and they put gravel and soil on top, and that will just, when the ground is saturated, all the water goes into the pipe and then slowly releases over time. So it's, instead of removing the water from your site, it actually is sequestering it there for the plants to reuse later. I mean, you may have been on the highway and you see these huge farms with these big trucks doing a trench, and they have this giant roll of this black pipe. That's what they're doing. It's called tiling. In the past, like on our property that was farmed way back in, we'll be back to the 1800s, if you dig around, you'll find the clay version, which is the red terracotta pipes that they would lay. Our property is crisscrossed with that because it was old farm and greenhouse property.
513-419-7100. You can also email your gardening questions to talk@wvxu.org. Bud sent us an email. He has a river birch with three trunks. One trunk is leaning over a neighbor's driveway. And his question is, can he cut down the one trunk without hurting the rest of the tree? Each trunk's about 2 feet thick, and this is a tree that's 30 feet tall.
Yeah, I mean, depending upon, I would really try to focus and make sure you don't hurt any of the other trunks. You know, you want to have a flush cut and make sure that all your tools are clean and that they're very sharp. But if at all possible, kind of take it down as close as you can to the soil line. and try to reduce any mechanical injury to any of those other healthy trunks that are doing well.
Yeah, one thing, too, to consider, if it's a major accent tree to your property, I mean, it's a big tree, it's a mature tree, you might be better off trying to just do it yourself is to hire a trained licensed arborist, because they may come and look at the tree and see some other options for you, maybe then just taking the whole thing down, or if it's taken down, they'll be able to do it in a way that, you know, you're not going to lose your investment.
Especially if it's a 30-foot tree.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big tree to take down on your end, but, yeah. You know, just be careful, rope it up if you are.
And it's very weak, and so they are very susceptible to breaking easily. So just I caution you. Yeah, so if you're not trained or experienced with that, yeah, seek, like it was already mentioned, seek a professional certified arborist.
Now, ornamental grass, I planted that for the first time last summer, and I trimmed it back in the fall, but I'm just wondering, is there anything I need to do to get it ready for the spring and the summer, Peter?
Well, you know, we leave our stand all winter, and so right about now we'll go out and cut it down. Now, one thing you can do is after you cut it off, and you kind of see where they kind of give it a crew cut, and it's kind of nice to kind of give it a little bit of a shape, but you take it down fairly close to the crown, and then it stimulates it to regrow. And so the nice thing about letting those stand over winter is you have sort of an architectural element in your landscape from those. Now, one thing that people do is they'll take that mass and compost it or put it in lawn bags and send it off to, you know, the composting facility or what. But you can also just take that grass, and some people will chop it up a little bit. Some people leave it as is, and they just put it around the base of the plant as in a mulch around the plant itself, around the ornamental grass, I should say. And so we usually just cut it and use it for mulch around the actual ornamental grass stand itself.
If you also leave it up all winter, that provides habitat for wildlife, you know, possibly if there's seeds on it for food for them. So,
and let's talk with Andy and Anderson, because Andy's also got some ornamental grass questions as well. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I don't know if it's an accepted term in the field, but I'm a brown thumb.
You and me both.
I have no inclinations or talents, but for some reason I'm listening to this show, and I know what reason I'm listening to it for. It's ornamental grasses. I have inherited some stumps, and I thought as I drove around town, wait a minute, ornamental grass might be a good surround or at least cover for one side of a tree stump. And so I wonder, A, is that a good idea? B, I don't think you have time for a lecture on ornamental grasses, but maybe a few of the basics, if there's any negatives or positives, low maintenance, high maintenance, sunshade, that kind of stuff.
Well, overall, I think ornamental grasses are very diverse and they're very forgiving. So they're very low maintenance as well. Typically, there's always exceptions to the rules, right? And so they typically like full sun, very low maintenance. Like we were mentioning, you can cut them back, prune them back late fall, early spring. But once you plant them, make sure it's in good soil. They typically like well-drained soil, or they prefer well-drained soil. Some like wet feet, so as we call that. So if you're having type of an erosion issue, you may plant some ornamental grasses to help with that area. But as long as they're, you know, full sun, you're pretty good to go, I think. Any other thoughts?
Well, the idea of concealing a stump, I mean, I've done that. I've taken the stump down. You know, I don't know how it would work around, you know, evergreens and conifers, but we had a maple and a mulberry once that we took down to the ground. And then I put kind of wood chips on top of that to kind of facilitate decomposition. Mm-hmm. And then what we did was I did plant some ornamental grasses around one of those stands, and they did fine. But you have to kind of go out away from it. But instead of, you know, if you did a circle around it, you're going to have like a hollow section in the center. I don't know how that's going to work out. But I kind of did them in front and around so that they kind of concealed.
And you could maybe put some other, you know, plant behind them, behind the trunk, and that way it doesn't just create sort of a circle, but it creates some kind of landscape aesthetic of sorts. So,
now, where locally can you find a nice variety of ornamental grass?
Well, most of the major nurseries you know, really are kind of carrying them, even some of the big box. But I always encourage people to try and go to small independent nurseries.
Yeah.
You can even order seeds online. Yeah. Most grass seeds are very easy to propagate and start from seed.
Yeah. Oh, you know, the first weekend, first Saturday in May, the Civic Garden Center does their annual plant sale. I think now they call it the plant sale. And they have a section of on grasses. But also, just in general, they have very good nursery stock. I think the prices are usually very reasonable. That would be a good place to go and look.
You might also want to make sure that it says clumping. You know, that'll actually help make sure that it's going to be a cluster. So,
and it's not a bad idea every, you know, 5 years or so to kind of break that clump up, share it, or expand your landscape. So ornamental grasses overall are really easy to maintain, and they're really nice to share over time.
513-419-7100 if you have any questions about your about gardening or yard work. Julie tweeted she wanted to know how can she get rid of chickweed.
It's actually a great spring ephemeral. You can eat it.
Yeah.
You can put it in your salad. And it's actually, I've heard that it'll help jumpstart your digestion in the spring.
Yeah, it's a bitter green. And it's interesting as part of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and working with refugees from Bhutan, the Bhutanese. And last summer they came out for a tour of Turner Farm, and we did the tour. And when we left, they said, can we go out in this field and harvest all the chickweed? Because it's an edible that they really, really like. And so it was kind of funny. It was like, I expected, can we have some kale? Can we have some? And I remember Melinda said, take all you want. And it was interesting also a couple of years ago with the city's urban agriculture program when I was working with the refugees from Burundi. It was the same thing. We come to the site, Westwood Northern, and the first thing they would do is get out of the van and go over and start harvesting chickweed, and then we would work in the garden.
And a lot of those obscure greens might have more minerals and nutrients than a lot of our standard cultivated crops. So
besides eating it, if you just don't want it, how do you get rid of it?
Oh, right. Yes. Forgot about the question.
Solarize it.
You could solarize it. It is a very noxious weed. Typically, we see it now. So it's a winter weed, and it will produce seed. So it can be very taxing on our time and our labor. So if you just have like a scaffold hoe, if it's in your vegetable garden or your ornamental garden, you can use a scaffold hoe. It's very shallow roots. My recommendation is to remove it from that piece of the property that you're trying to eradicate, because unlike some other weeds that you may want to use it as green manure to incorporate into your soil management, it will reroot very easily. So maybe remove it from that site and put it into a compost pile and compost it that way.
And you said solarize it, right?
You can solarize it.
Covering it with plastic, you know, black plastic, clear plastic. And, you know, that's a simple organic method. Same with hoeing.
There are herbicide tactics as well, but with any weed management, it be in your turf or in your vegetable garden or in your ornamental garden, you want to properly identify that weed. For example, chickweed is a broadleaf weed, so you want to make sure that you identify that it's seasoned and understand different chemical tactics. You can use synthetic or you can use organic approaches, but there's not one type of chemical control that will control all weeds. So just make sure you identify that and understand the biology behind it before you just buy an herbicide and start spraying. And what you could use in your turf may not then transfer to your ornamental, your vegetable garden. So understand that. Always read labels.
What about burning weeds?
Well, there is a technique where you have a torch and you kind of scorch off the top. And the thing that's interesting to remember when you're doing this, you're usually using that with small, tender, younger plants. And you singe it. You don't stand there forever and just bake it. You know, that's people make a mistake, but you just kind of search, you know. And there's a number of techniques in agriculture where when they plant carrot seeds, and then early in the season, and early on, a lot of weeds will start to invasive or non-desirable weeds will grow in the carrot beds. And while they're very young, they'll just lightly torch all those small weeds, and then the carrot seeds take longer to germinate. Then they come up, and then you have a weed-free bed.
513-419-7100 if you have any questions about gardening. Let's talk with Carrie in Deer Park. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I have an area where my neighbor had two trees, and one is being cut down, but it's a corner that's kind of wasted now, and I'd like to plant something to make it look better. I was thinking rhododendrons, but I've got roots. I don't know whether a live plant can compete with the roots, even if one of the tree stumps, one of them is now dead, or if not rhododendrons, if there's anything I can do with that area.
Okay, so roots live for a very long time, and yes, roots can be a challenge to eradicate and to plant another desirable shrub or tree in there. So rhododendrons are great, but depending upon your soil practice, they tend to like, they don't like full sun. There are some varieties that that will do well in full sun, but in acidic soil. So really make sure you get your soil tested before you're going to invest in your landscape to understand what type of soil you have, and therefore that will give you a guideline of where to start and choose your plant material.
One thing I wonder, too, is what type of tree was there before. I guess she's not online anymore, but if it was a coniferous tree, if it had acidified the soil. And most of our soil, you know, from especially if you're in the Cincinnati area, are mostly heavy clays that are more basic than acidic. And so if it was a coniferous tree before, maybe it could withstand a rhododendron at that point. But
do you recommend planting flowers or herbs under a tree in an expanded bed, or is that going to take too many nutrients away from the plant you put around the tree?
A lot of our minerals and nutrients are actually fixed by understory plants and natural ecosystems, and so they're known as dynamic accumulators. And so, you know, a lot of your flowers, they can be complementary. It depends, though, if they're, you know, it just depends on the types of flowers. You know, indigo is a great plant. It probably could handle, you know, want to make sure it can handle shade, first off, you know, and the type of shade, depending on the tree. If it's a locust versus an oak tree, you know, you're going to have heavy, dense shade with an oak versus a locust. And then, you know, from there, you know, trying to identify, you know, what kind of flowers would work the best from there. And, you know, it's a great compliment. So
I do caution planting a lot of our annual crops and edible crops under walnut trees, because it does produce a toxin naturally. And so, for example, like Solanaceae crops, like our tomatoes and peppers, are very sensitive to that natural toxin in the root system and in the plant itself. So, and always remember that roots can extend 2 to 3 times the tree canopy, you know. So just because it's in your neighbor's yard, remember that you could potentially have some effect in your landscape and vice versa.
Yeah, and the trees are also competing for moisture, you know, those roots, and the kind of, so you have to kind of watch your anything around them any more water. But you know, thinking about in terms of permaculture, Braden, I mean, there's the concept of the guild, the plant guild underneath fruit trees, where you may use comfrey, you know, garlic, chives, daffodils, thyme, different herbs underneath to kind of build a community that also kind of provides, in some cases, like comfrey provides a habitat for beneficial insects to overwinter. And then and other things that are more aromatic, like the chives, can be act as a kind of a way of keeping insects away from the tree.
We will continue our conversation, and we'll take your gardening questions at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon, Executive Director of ThisLand.org and Chairman of the City of Cincinnati's Urban Agriculture Advisory Board, Braden Trouth, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Braden, tell us about Growing Values.
Growing Value is a nursery that we started as a fundraiser for the Cincinnati Permaculture Institute, or thisland.org. We started it about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's located next to Building Value, And you can always go down there. It's a self-service nursery. It's primarily a fundraiser, as I mentioned. You can buy the plants through Building Value. But we specialize in perennial edibles for the Cincinnati area. And it's a niche area that a few nurseries have, you know, some good plant stock. But we recognize that there is a general lack of some, you know, the wide variety of perennial edibles that can be grown around here. So, you know, we have a lot of fruit trees. We have a lot of nut trees. We actually just started carrying the only citrus that'll grow in the area, trifoliate orange, which you can actually make key lime pies from. It's not really for fresh eating, but if you want to be local and you want to support local diet, and you can get your local oranges. So,
and what would some good perennial edibles be good for in this area? What would be some good ones to grow around here?
Well, we have a lot of your standard fruits, you know, your apples, peaches, pears, nectarines, cherries. I find some of the easiest to be cherries along with pears. Kefir pears are a real easy one. But then also nut trees. We have hazelnuts. We have pecans. We have chestnuts, southern pecans that we've been experimenting with, you know, with climate change. We actually have two southern pecans that have survived at our nursery for the last several years. Those are the last two that we have in stock, actually. But and then we have northern pecans. We have a whole slew of different, you know, edibles. So also perennial vegetables. Asparagus, you know, is a perennial vegetable. We're working on trying to get more sea kale, which is a perennial kale that you can use for edible landscaping. So,
yeah, speaking of asparagus, Braden, Joy emailed us. She said her asparagus didn't do so well last year, so she's wondering if she should fertilize this year.
It's a good question. I mean, asparagus is a tricky one. It will naturalize in this area, which, you know, goes to tell me that, you know, it doesn't need much, you know, in general. If it's able to naturalize, it doesn't need much. But in terms of production, you know, compost, adding compost never hurts. You know, it's going to help enhance the soil microbiology, which really a lot of new science is actually discovering that soil fertility is actually more created by the soil microorganisms rather than per se, you know, adding lacked minerals and nutrients. So, you know, and Dr. Elaine Ingham, you can look into her research. She's really pioneered a lot of work in terms of soil microbiology and how natural ecosystems actually produce minerals and nutrients for themselves. So,
yeah. Well, I was going to say, one thing about asparagus, it's like, you know, from the start, if you need to trench properly, you need to put in a good soil and give it some fertility early on. That's one plant more than any other perennial that I think you really need that. It's important to do that advanced prep. And then, like Braden said, side dressing with compost I think is a good plan. But I was going to remember it's like at least 3 years before you start it. And I think it's really more 4 or 5 before you really start getting really good, you know, shoot, a lot of shoots and a lot of good harvest out of it.
The other thing, too, is 2 winters ago, we had a little bit harsher of a winter, you know, where we got down to, I think, maybe -5 or maybe -10. And if it wasn't planted deep enough, that could have actually set it back.
And so. Yeah, I personally, you know, I have some 2-year-old plants, clumps, and, you know, it's just mulching it a little bit with some straw, and then I actually let those fronds develop, and then right when those new shoots start to emerge, that's when I cut the old spears back. So there's a lot of different information out there. If possible, you know, you may just need to try out in your landscape. They like full sun and well-drained soil. And there is one little pest that likes to feed on them. It's the asparagus black beetle. And when they're there, they will shred it to pieces very quickly. So utilizing some best management tactics such as the row covers, but also using some insecticidal soaps, it does the job. If there are anything else that you need, again, contact your local extension office.
Can you plant asparagus right now, or is it better to wait on that?
finding it may be your culprit, you know, number one. So typically if I don't see it at the nursery, then it's probably not the best time to start planting. But yeah, you definitely want to get that in. You can find them starting in the spring. If you can find, mainly finding at your nurseries, and when you get them, they're just their roots, and typically they're a little dry, and one may think, well, this looks dead or not alive. You will not see green on the plant that you will receive or the rootstock that you'll receive. So just be aware that it may look a little dead, but it's not.
Grace in Waynesville joins us now. Hi, Grace.
Hello.
You can go right ahead.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how to get rid of yucca plants. I have an area that was planted maybe 20 years ago, and last year I covered them with newspaper and buried them under mulch, dug as many up as I could, but now I'm getting new shoots even yet this year. So I haven't wanted to use an herbicide on it, but I'm at a loss as to what to do.
Are yucca plants that stubborn?
Yuck.
Yep.
So advice for Grace.
Yeah.
It could be one of those very noxious or one may think very invasive landscape plants. So, yeah, digging, but you may look at their root system and note that you may not get it all in one shot. So if you can be very patient, if you're not wanting to use any type of herbicide, you may try solarization, but it could be I would chop it down as close to the soil as possible. Not really sure effectively how that would work, but if you then have to reserve to an herbicide, utilize a non-selective herbicide and literally paintbrush it on to reduce any exposure or drift to any other desirable plant. But that may be your last resort.
Yeah, I would think digging it out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, mm-hmm. solarizing, I'd be worried that root is, goes down so deep that it may not kill it off.
And again, for those who might have missed what solarizing is, that's just covering it up?
Yep, covering it with plastic, black plastic, clear plastic. Black plastic probably will get hotter over in the long run.
Yeah, I had done that as part of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program. We did some field tests actually this last year to prepare beds for planting the following season and in end of July into August for four to 6 weeks. We laid down, I used clear plastic and let it sit and then rolled it up. And
kind
it
of just, worked like a magnifying glass, I guess.
Yeah, well, it creates, it just heats it up and it just burns it. Yeah. I mean, you may have noticed if you put plastic down on your grass at home when someone makes a soil delivery or something, I mean, I've seen that'll kill your grass in sometimes just 4 hours. Yep. But to really go down and destroy the roots, you need to do 4 to 6 weeks. And we found it to be extremely effective.
Yeah. Just make sure you really anchor it down into the soil. Don't step on it. If you have any four-legged friends, making sure that you try to border that area, and if any hole comes up, if there's a hole, the seeds will germinate.
Let's talk with John in Morgan County. Hi, John.
Hey, I'm thinking of putting cedars along between a creek that's on my property and the road. It's about 30 feet between the two. But I do a lot of traveling. I'm from Morgan County, over this in southeastern Ohio. But when I travel over here towards Cincinnati, I see along the highway, the cedars over here almost invasive. They're down in the medial strip on the highway, and it looks like the saplings are actually cut down with the mowers that do the landscaping between the highway, between the interstate. And I just don't want to plant something that is going to end up being invasive. You know, it takes off and is invasive. Where I'm from, it's more of a individual. You know, cedars are more individual, but down here, there's nothing like I've ever seen.
Cedars are a native plant, and they tend to grow in degraded soils. I see them a lot throughout farms in the rolling hills of Kentucky and along southern Ohio, and it's because of overgrazing primarily, where the soil's just been, you know, heavily degraded, and they tend to come in. And they're one of the few things that will actually survive in that ecosystem. They're one of the pioneer species, if you will, in this ecosystem. So I wouldn't worry too much about planting them. They provide great habitat for wildlife. And they also provide great windbreaks and timber too, if you have a lot of them. I've recommended that.
Know on our highways there's a lot of disturbed soils, air, and so anytime you disturb the soil or that topography, you're going to have things native, that are cedars, that will bounce back. And then you have road crews that may have to run another pipe or anything like that and cut the existing ones down. So there's unfortunately a high turnover rate with plant native, typically, our plant material on the roadway. So I wouldn't use that as an example of how your landscape will look in your rural settings.
It's all relative to the soil. And so when they build these highways, they're cutting into the soil, they're cutting into the bedrock, and they're one of the few things that'll grow almost out of, you know, very little soil with a lot of bedrock. So in your landscape, it's probably going to have a lot more soil, and because of that, they're not going to be as aggressive. So
let's talk with Marvin in Milford. Good afternoon, Marvin.
Good afternoon. I have a question on English ivy. You touched on it briefly at your opening caller, but what about trying to get rid of it permanently? It's well established, and it's sort of taking over, and is there any way to get rid of ivy permanently?
I'm going to write you a prescription for patience. So just be patient and continue, especially when it's not actively growing in the fall and in the winter months, to use your mower if possible. If there are larger clumps or establishments in certain areas in your landscape, focus on that first. It does prove that solarization will work if you want to test that out in certain areas. And then as the last culprit, after a mowing, you can use some herbicide, again, organic or synthetic, and paintbrush it on there. But really, if you get those clumps out and you can dig out those, what we call the very mature or mother clumps, you'll have a greater success. And just caution you on tearing it off any trees or any structure, because it can cause damage.
You know, one thing you can do, too, is what I've done is along the edge of a building or along the base of a tree, you know, I cut it off at ground level. So you're starving, and then you can maybe remove like a couple inches and so that you disconnect it. And then I just let it decompose on its own and fall off.
Yeah.
It's a good way to go. I've noticed in Spring Grove Cemetery, I've seen some trees with it seems like they're using that technique
and
also.
And that's how you would use that same tactic for poison ivy as well, I suggest. Yeah.
Richard in College Hill gets the last question of the day. Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
Go right ahead.
Okay, my question is that I had a mature tree. It was a white oak, and it was in decline, so I had it cut down. And since then, it's in a position where you really can't get one of those grinders back there. So I've tried to use various commercial products, drill holes, put it in there.
And Richard, can you get to the question real quick, because we're running short on time?
Okay, the question is, what product to use to get rid of the tree stump that's 30 inches in diameter?
I don't know if there's a quick fix. Again, patience. You want to add a little nitrogen. Nitrogen, just like our compost, increases the decomposition rate. So I know it may sound funny, but those holes, getting air in there, drying it out, and adding a little bit of pure nitrogen will, again, increase that decomposition.
Yep.
Sarah, Peter, and Braden, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.